Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm really pleased to host Alessio Terzi and Diane Coyle. Alessio Terzi has just published a book at Harvard University Press called Good for Growth and is going to talk about the book. And we have Diane Coyle to react and give us her comments, her views on this book. And of course, Diane, you're a distinguished academic and have published on many issues, but also on the big questions of the interaction of economics and sustainability, which is, I think, at the core of this book. Before we go into the conversation, I really want to give Alessio a chance to kick us off by just sort of giving us a snapshot, sort of what's the bottom line of the book in 5 minutes. I mean, you're basically arguing that it is possible to continue to grow while at the same time respecting the planetary boundaries, which is something that a lot of academics see very critically at the current stage. So what's your argument and how do you make that pitch?
Absolutely. Thanks for hosting. I'm glad to be home, back at Bruegel. You already gave a bit of the snapshot of what the book is about. I'd like to rewind just a second to speak about the genesis of this book, which I feel like helps me to anchor the discussion into the wider debate. We go back to the early phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. You might recall there was a new virus spreading. And so governments reacted by enacting stay-at-home orders or lockdown measures. And so we were locked at home and everything was going bad. So let's say the public health situation was bad, the economy was tanking. And for those who were looking for a silver lining, the silver lining could have been that, you know, at least CO2 emissions were dropping and the quality of the air was improving and the quality of water was improving. And at some point, even dolphins were spotted in Venice's canals. And I mean, later, those pictures of dolphins were proved to be fabricated. But the wider point sort of stuck with me, which is, could it be, because we need to bring these CO2 emissions down and we need for nature to heal, to use, let's say, journalistic terms, could it be, even beyond COVID and once COVID is gone, could it be that we have to shrink the size of the economy in order to avoid a climate catastrophe and to avoid further environmental degradation? And that's a bit how the whole discussion or reflection for me started, which was a reflection on, but what is this concept of economic growth? What is the relationship with nature? Why do we seem to be obsessed with it? When has it started in a way? So there's also a historical component, because in order to understand what the relationship with nature is, it forces you to understand economic growth per se. So that's a bit what the book is about. It's a book that started with a very open mind. I've realized when talking to fellow authors that many times people start with knowing what they want to argue and then writing a book around it, building a narrative in order to persuade people. And this wasn't the case for me. It was a book of whys that started with a general question. As I started digging, it became wider and wider. As I was mentioning, it forced me to reflect on also the link between capitalism and economic growth, or the link between capitalism and nature. And that's also why the final product is a book that is broad. It is a book that forced me to go multidisciplinary as well, because I had to draw from many disciplines in trying to answer several questions. So, for example, where does this desire for more originate from? If we come to the conclusion, as economists would, that it is these preferences for non-satiation, let's say, which is the way we model them in our basic macroeconomic models, where does this desire for more come from? And although economics often stops there and takes that almost as an axiom of preferences, other disciplines have gone into the nuts and bolts of why people desire more, how do they use new tools or objects in the relationship within societies. So I'm thinking of sociology that has been looking at this, and so on and so forth. And so it has been a very interesting multidisciplinary journey.
So Alessio, I mean, sorry to push you now sort of on the main message. I mean, it's quite interesting that you start with the pandemic. And of course, in the pandemic, we've seen that global emissions actually went down. They did go down. And people were joking, well, basically to go to net zero in terms of emissions, so to basically zero emissions by 2050, we need one COVID recession every year to basically reach that goal. So basically several percentage points of lowering of emissions every year to actually reach the zero by 2050. Now, in the end, you seem to say, well, we don't need these kind of recessions every year, which, of course, would be politically difficult to fabricate. So you have a much more optimistic message, and perhaps you can give us your reasoning around this optimistic message before, then I would bring in Diane from the University of Cambridge to give her view on that. So why, in the end, after reading and seeing actually the supposedly very positive result of the pandemic, right? I mean, we finally managed to bring down emissions, which we never did globally, right? I mean, the emissions have been rising for the last more than 100 years. Finally, we bring it down, but that's not the way to go. So degrowth is not the way to go. Tell us why not.
No, absolutely. I come to the conclusion that it's not the way to go. And let's say the standard counter argument to what you have just said is that, you know, this was a recession that was forced by COVID and it was structured in a way that could have been made better, let's say. And so if you had organized it in a planned way and managing huge levels of redistribution and so on, it could have been more equitable and politically palatable. So I go into even a deeper reflection on these points, but I come to the conclusion that this is not the best way to go. And the argument is sort of twofold. The first argument is that is more technological, and the second is more social. And the technological argument is that I come to the conclusion that actually economic growth and innovation and technology are two sides of the same coin. And that actually there's nothing intrinsic in the definition or in the concept of economic growth that says, you know, you have to burn fossil fuels, you must produce CO2 emissions, or you will not have economic growth. It is true that our current model of economic growth has been based on this, but it's not something that is intrinsic in the concept of growth. And the second argument against ditching growth, which I was saying is more social, links to the fact that growth makes more resources available in general as a broad concept. And if instead resources become constrained, which is what a degrowth type of literature would say, and they would say, you know, they're constrained, but we share them better and more equally. And what I conclude is that actually when resources are constrained, sharing between groups in society or among societies becomes harder and harder. And so that the likelihood of this peaceful reconciliation between countries or within countries in the face of reduced resources is probably wishful thinking, and instead what would follow is probably a wave of violence, and we want to avoid that, obviously.
It's lots of point to discuss here, Diane, and I do want to bring you in. I think sort of the two arguments, one is, well, technical feasibility, and the other argument is distributional constraints in a shrinking economy or resource-constrained economy would make the kind of distribution that degrowth advocates really push quite unlikely. What's your first reaction when you saw these main arguments in the book?
It's a really rich and interesting book, and I do commend it to everybody because I think it's important to engage seriously with the degrowth arguments, which have quite a lot of traction, but seem to me to rest on some misunderstandings. And also, actually, to pick up on the last point that you and Alessia were discussing, Guntram, was the sort of political dishonesty of it. Nobody is going to vote for a COVID recession every year. And the reason we like growth is that it means living standards go up and you can't get redistribution if you have a shrinking set of resources. And that just isn't touched on often when people are making the degrowth case. So there's that political economy set of issues, and we might come back and discuss that. It has been the case that growth has been unsustainable. We've been depleting natural capital, and that means that current consumption has happened at the expense of the future. And that's got to change, and it's got to accelerate. And the challenge is how to do that without reducing people's living standards or making it impossible to tackle low incomes and poverty. But there is some good news. The energy intensity and the material input intensity of GDP has been going down over time. So that can be done. Let's talk about how we accelerate that. And I think the important thing in terms of how we think about it is embedding the economy in nature. My colleague in Cambridge, Partha Dasgupta, published a fantastic report last year about biodiversity, but really about embedding thinking about the human economy in the natural economy, because we're part of that. So let's change the way we talk about growth to be a sustainable metric. And there's a lot of work in economics about how to do that, which some colleagues of mine and I work on. So for sure, let's do that. But the misunderstanding, I think, is that people's intuitions about growth are material intuitions. We're using more resource inputs, rare earth minerals, and we're using that to produce motor cars and handbags. And actually, modern growth isn't like that. In the developed economies, it hasn't been like that since at least 1980. It's non-material. It's innovation. It's ideas. In fact, some ideas, like just-in-time production, require less use of resource, not more use of resource. Or think about something like the invention of the COVID vaccines, which add to GDP. There are transactions that take place, and they add to human capital. So if you want degrowth, are you really saying that we're going to stop innovations happening? Or if we want an innovation, we're going to take away something? You can have your vaccine, but only if you give up having smartphones. And that's just a misunderstanding that economic value can attach to intangibles, and increasingly does so in modern economies. So the real sympathy I have with people who advocate for degrowth, apart from the fact that we've not been sustainable and we need to fix that, capitalism isn't working. And it's not working because people's incomes haven't been going up. Median incomes in many countries growing slowly for at least a decade now. That's why we see political polarization and dissent. But actually, you fix that with more growth. It just needs to be much more sustainable growth.
So, Diane, let me push you also a little bit. And I mean, for full disclosure, let me say that I also recently published an article where I come actually to very close conclusions than Alessio has come to. But I mean, let me push you on the degrowth argument. And I got a lot of referee reports basically telling me, look, I mean, all this green growth story, it's never going to work. We actually have to grow less. And they did not believe that it's going to be feasible to, as you say, move away from material growth towards more intangible and, I guess, less resource-intensive growth. And, you know, looking at the numbers, the task looks really, really daunting. I mean, you really need to bring down emissions. And let's just take sort of the IPCC framework. You need to bring down emissions to basically zero by 2050, and you need to bring it down very, very substantially by 2030 to avoid exceeding the 2 degree or 1.5 degree Celsius goal. So yes, we can grow with less material than you used to, but is the speed of dematerialization of our economy, is that actually feasible? I think we come to the number you have to increase that speed of dematerialization of our growth by a factor of 7 or something like this as of now, to reach the zero by 2050. So can we do it, Diane, or are fundamentally the degrowth proponents not having a point here?
Even if you think they've got a point, they're not going to be able to deliver what they think is needed. I just think that's politically infeasible. And the trouble is that the changes that we need to make in the way the economic system operates to have sustainable green growth also look infeasible. So we're in a debate about comparing infeasibilities. And I'm going to put my bet on green growth, partly because some of the innovations that we need are innovations that will happen anyway. If you think about things like additive printing or the development of graphene and smart materials, those are going to be less material and less energy intensive. And I think the real challenge is about where you hit boundaries or tipping points much sooner, and energy is the obvious one of those, and the system changes we need in transportation, energy generation, construction to deliver that. They're big system changes, and that's really hard to do. I suppose I take some comfort from the fact that everybody I know working in any of those areas is extremely focused on how to accelerate getting to sustainability. Colleagues across the university working in engineering or in architecture, that's all they think about. So there's a huge effort going into it. Ultimately, though, I think it's about the politics. And will governments step up and deliver the coordination that's needed to change those structures that we have in place already?
Alessio, let me get your views on this and develop perhaps your argument in your book a little bit further. And I guess it's fair to say, for full disclosure, also you currently work in the European Commission. Now, the book is written by you as an individual, but you work in the European Commission that does officially talk about green growth. That's the view of the president of the European Commission. But then you have important agencies within the European Commission where, for example, the Environmental Agency, where typically you have more natural scientists working, that openly actually advocate degrowth as a model, which is, of course, institutionally very strange that you have two, within the same institution, you have quite publicly voiced different opinions. So what's your main reason of optimism why you think it's actually going to be feasible?
I think you're going straight to the heart of the book, and indeed the central chapters, some of my favorite actually, chapter 5 and chapter 6 are exactly looking at what you were mentioning. So on the one side, what is the likelihood that people will just turn around their preferences and embrace a principle of sufficiency and so give up this desire for more, and therefore that we can live politically, the political feasibility that Diane was talking about, and that this will happen. And so there's a full discussion about why that is highly unlikely to happen. But then this has to be stacked against what you were mentioning, which is there is a technological problem in the fact that we have been decarbonizing, but we have been doing so only too slowly. And if that were to proceed at this pace, it would take us a century at least to get where we need to. And so we have to accelerate big times on that. And I think my optimism comes from looking at the history of innovation and how innovation comes about, and notably how it comes about under capitalism, that with all its negative sides or correct criticism, is an efficient machinery at doing only one thing, which is churning out innovation and growth. Then how these resources get distributed and so on is something that is best left to other mechanics and perhaps to liberal democracy, as I argue in the book and whatnot. But it is an efficient machinery to foster innovation. And what I try to say in the book is that we're going to need a lot of that, precisely because we need to accelerate on the transition. And we have this tool that is very good at doing that. And when you look at the history of innovation, you realize that actually, you know, you can look at industrial revolutions of the past, but in general, the spread of innovation happens along S-curves. So it happens at some point exponentially. And we are seeing it with some of the technologies that we are looking at right now. I mean, I'm thinking of the first hybrid cars, for example. They came out in late 1990s. I think the Toyota Prius was 1997. So this technology has been around for a very long time, but it was picking up on only very slowly. And now we're seeing an exponential surge. So we are in the S, or in the exponential phase of an S-curve in terms of the technological pickup. And I think that it's all a matter of having the incentives straight, and that then once the incentives are straight within the system and that the price mechanism can play out within a capitalistic system, the pace at which this happens can be extremely fast.
If I can just add a bit to that, people have sort of linear intuitions of how change happens, but of course, as Alessia says, that's not the case. And you can think of other examples like smartphones, invented, launched in 2007, and they have absolutely transformed the way that we live our lives and the way that businesses operate in a really short space of time. So people's behavior can also change very quickly. And, you know, in a sense, it doesn't require governments to do a lot once the innovation process has started. So it's a question of setting technical standards or using existing government procurement tools to guarantee that some markets will exist and de-risk things a bit for investors. So we've seen the price of photovoltaic cells decline even faster than Moore's law made the cost of computing decline. So I'm not at all complacent about this process. I think it does need political work and policy work.
So perhaps we can spend a few minutes on the more political process and also the system question. I mean, you mentioned liberal democracy. No, liberal democracy is not running the world. It's only in parts of the world in place. So how do you see the sort of the global question, if we sort of talk just about the decarbonization part and not the biodiversity part? But let's just talk about the decarbonization part. Decarbonization is a global need, right? It's a global public good, and we need everybody to be on board, but not everybody might have the right incentives. So how do you solve this global political competition around resources?
That's a very good question. It's maybe one of the few places where the book steps out of the mainstream. So maybe it's good then we can have a conversation about it. But what I try to say there is that indeed, for a very long time, you know, climate change has been characterized as this global problem that requires a global solution, which on the surface of it is obviously true. And in principle, it makes a lot of sense. What I try to say in the book is that for a variety of reasons, including how climate change will materialize in practice, how it will hit certain countries before others, how some countries will have the resources to try and avoid the worst effects of climate change, how these are, obviously this overlaps with relations between countries that are tense for a variety of reasons. We are not likely to see this moment in which countries all come together and bury all hatchets and together solve the problem of climate change.
So it's not COP27 that's going to solve the climate.
What I try to say in the book is that there's always a lot of expectations around the COPs, and a lot of articles get written after the COPs as to why governments have been narrow-minded and our leaders have been narrow-minded and couldn't see the obvious that we have to come with a final treaty that mandates decarbonization at the global level. And what I say in the book is that this is not going to happen, which doesn't mean that the COPs are useless. It means they are a useful forum for loose coordination, for setting standards, for some naming and shaming, which can't do bad, for attracting the public attention on these issues. But it is not the place where policies will be determined at the global level and mandated at the global level, neither now nor in the foreseeable future. And so I try to come up with a decarbonization strategy that is in countries' direct interest, and so that it makes sense for individual countries. And there I sort of separate in two big baskets, let's say the early movers, which are rich countries, and the rest, so emerging markets. And I try to set reasons or a strategy that overall makes sense and makes it in countries' direct interest to pursue this decarbonization.
So early movers, the rich countries are the early movers. They are, of course, historically the biggest polluters and have contributed the most to the stock of CO2 in the atmosphere. So they clearly should move first. The US, Europe have clearly a bigger responsibility. Diane, what's your take on the global coordination issue?
I once took part in a workshop with Thomas Schelling, where he essentially said he thought that the COP process, he didn't refer to it as that, but solving that kind of coordination problem at the global level was not going to be possible. So he would absolutely agree with Alessio. We're in a second best world, and I think we're going to have to look for other kinds of devices. And it might be that the world we're in, it's carbon border taxes. You might foresee situations where the burning of the rainforest in the Amazon gets linked to wildfires and droughts in the American breadbasket. And so there's a case for the US to pay for ecosystem services to stop Brazilian farmers burning down the rainforest. So perhaps that kind of mechanism could emerge. But the global problem is going to become local. Many countries will experience damages, and not only low-income countries, from climate change. And so I think national governments are going to start doing what they can separately anyway.
So the best coordination mechanism is actually the fact that we are all experiencing climate change, and therefore we act because of local pressures.
Exactly.
Alessio, walk us through the chapters that we haven't covered yet in the book. Which ones would you think deserve a bit more attention?
There's one chapter that is a bit of a case study and that makes the book much more practical. And the book has a practical angle. Let's say it starts with something that is up in the sky and historical and theoretical, but it then tries to become very practical. And there's one chapter that is really a case study, let's say, on using Italy as an example and saying, you know, like, this is an example of a country that effectively lived in a steady state economy for 30 years, and therefore showing how it is not only me, you know, doing a mental exercise, imagining all these negative dynamics, but actually when you are in a zero growth environment, this unleashes a wide set of negative dynamics, especially when you're in a world where the others don't move like you. And so this coordination problem that we were talking about for climate change applies also for a degrowth type of mentality, which is no single country will ever have this incentive on its own to go down this path. And then there is another chapter which I'm fond of, which is the final one, that I've realized that the man on the street or the woman on the street is perhaps less focused on, but fellow economists are extremely focused on, which is the one on the so-called macro, green macro. And so what happens to growth and jobs when if we were to do these Build Back Better or European Green Deal type of policies, and we were to do all this, what would happen to growth? And in that chapter, I take a stance that, you know, again, because I look at it through the lenses of something that looks more like an industrial revolution, and I argue why this would be the case, why the green transition is not only a matter of increasing a little bit prices of carbon here and there, it is a matter of restructuring the whole of production, the whole of consumption, the whole of transport, the whole of food, so on and so forth. It is closer to an industrial revolution. And so in that, it makes sense to be an early mover, because that's where you set standards in a way, and you secure that in the industrial revolution type of pattern, you are in the winning league of countries that have the comparative advantage in the sectors of the future, in the technologies of the future, and that this will generate for countries that move fast, both growth and jobs.
So green macro, the first mover has an advantage. Diane, what's your take on that point? I mean, it certainly doesn't always feel like this when you look at domestic politics. Very often you would hear the exact counter argument: let's not move first because we want to avoid the macroeconomic costs. We want to avoid too many stranded assets. We want to avoid that we move earlier, and you know the rest of the world just benefits from us being first movers while we pay the bill. So, would you subscribe to the argument that the first mover actually has an advantage?
I think I would. I mean, this argument that you just put forward is made with every set of innovations, and the incumbents say, oh, you can't possibly let that happen because look at all the jobs that will go. And then the countries that do let it happen, that let the competition thrive, competition for the market, they're the ones that take the lead in the new technologies and experience the growth. You know, again, we're back to the political economy. It's pretty hard for governments to resist that kind of lobbying from incumbents, but I think I would agree. I mean, the other incentive is green finance, and it's the negative case, if you like, that there are risks emerging to future profits for existing companies that are not fully accounted for in the price of corporate bonds or sovereign bonds. And so the financial mechanisms will kick in as well.
If I may, just one word. Again, when you look at the history of it and you look at the past, it's extremely interesting, even for fossil fuel cars. So I was reading a bit about the history of the early fossil fuel cars, and you realize that, you know, it is selected innovations mainly happening in Germany, and it's still like people that whose name we remember. So it's the Daimlers, it's the Maybachs.
Porsches.
Yeah, who did the early innovation. Mm. And then like for 100 years or more, effectively, but the country has benefited from being an early mover, and this has been central to the growth model of a country. And so that's what I have in mind when I say it is important to be at the forefront of this industrial revolution, and this will create jobs in the technologies of the future.
Well, now the market cap of a company like Tesla is well above that of, I think, the entire European car industry. So, Alessio, is Europe already behind the curve, actually? I mean, we are pretending that with the Green Deal we are sort of trying to be ahead of the curve and, you know, really winning the race and, you know, being the first movers. But when you look at market cap of some of these companies, it doesn't seem to be in Europe. Or do I mistake something?
I guess it depends. You were mentioning Tesla, but if you look instead at wind turbine companies, some of the Europeans are among the biggest ones in the world. But that's just one example. And in general, I think Europe has the potential to be at the forefront of this technology. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen on its own. It doesn't mean that it's a certainty. But if we do it right, I totally see the possibility of this happening, much more than in other sectors or fields. So, for example, on digital, we are lagging behind big times with respect to China and the US, and this is not going to be invented magically or rapidly.
There are lots of bits of the race as well. Think about materials. Europe can be ahead in materials, for example.
So, Diane, you're also optimistic that Europe and the UK, of course, part of Europe, has a chance to still lead in this industrial revolution?
Yes, but it needs to be taken seriously. So this requires investment in the basic science, the right kinds of incentives for the startups, competition policy to allow incumbents to be overturned. So I don't know if I'm optimistic or not, but I think it's feasible.
All right. So I had to play the devil's advocate in this conversation, unfortunately, even though I pretty much agree with both of you that this is a huge opportunity and that we actually can manage to do this if we take it seriously and can take the lead. But I had to play the devil's advocate to get the conversation going. So thank you so much, Diane. Thank you so much, Alessio. And congratulations, Alessio, again on your book. I mean, it's been for you a tremendous journey. I first met you when you were a research assistant at Bruegel, and now you are a book author at Harvard University Press. So congratulations for that journey. And Diane, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts and insights on this very important topic.
Very important topic indeed, and a great book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And this was it for today's Sound of Economics. Please do come back to our podcast. And if you like it, please do promote it on your social media channels. And thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.